Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello there, it's the last weekend of April. Sit back and have a listen to the Weekend Podcast and follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, one of the coolest Irish people ever, disco queen Roisin Murphy, sings it back and chats Arklow fashion. Eurovision icon Dana brushed up as our visiting critic and reminisced about winning the competition 55 years ago. John Patrick McHugh's great novel is a yarn about messy, cruel young lads in the West during the GAA Championship season, and he rounds off the podcast, so have a listen and stay in touch. Hi, very welcome back. Roisin Murphy is one of the coolest people Ireland has ever produced, full stop. Such is her singularity as an artist. She didn't follow in anyone's footsteps and nobody's managed to emulate her since. The disco queen herself, she brings her 30 years of mega hits home to Wicklow for the very first time. She's headlining the Beyond the Pale weekend. That's happening in June. And on the side, she campaigns for an art centre in her native Arklow. Roisin Murphy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're in Ibiza right now.
I am, yeah.
Is it beautiful there?
It is. The sun is shining. It's lovely.
Oh, that's perfect. And I know you're very familiar with the island. What is it like these days? Is it a sleepy place now? Has it calmed down from the party days?
It's starting to wake up a little bit now. but it's very sleepy during the winter, which is a lovely time actually to be here.
Oh, wow. I don't know if you read Matt Haig's novel, The Life Impossible, and it's all about the arts and heritage of Ibiza. It's a very cultured place.
No, I haven't read that, but that does sound interesting.
That's a hot recommendation for you. Far from Arklow, because Arklow is a place we don't have a kind of a grip on in Ireland, I don't think. We don't know it very well.
You haven't a grip on it. Arklow, yeah, Arklow's a great place, brilliant place to grow up. Full of wonderful people. I was just there a few weeks ago, weeks ago. And it's still home.
Where do you hang out when you go home?
I hang out in the Harbour Bar in Tinahask in Arklow.
And you sing there occasionally?
If they let me.
Do they say no sometimes to you?
They do get fairly pissed off if they're not in the humour.
There's a Harbour Bar in Bray, but there's one in Arklow, lesser known, but you've put it on the map. What was your life like growing up? What was your childhood like in Arklow?
It was great, actually. It was a brilliant place to be a kid. And I was surrounded by music. Mm-hmm. I had a great musician in my family, a guy called Jim Turl. And he had several bands. He had jazz band that I used to go and watch every Sunday during the summer. They have an all-day effort every Sunday. And I grew up listening to live music. I grew up listening to people singing all the time. And I had a fabulous family on both sides. Yeah. So, yeah, I was very lucky to grow up there. I consider myself lucky.
And your father, he worked very hard. I think you said in an interview somewhere that he fitted out maybe a quarter of the pubs in Ireland.
He did. He worked hard and he played hard.
And you love being the youngster in pubs, surrounded by older people and listening to them.
Yeah, I did. I wonder do you think that's still the case as much as it was then? I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
So much sitting around in the pub with your potatoes and your red lemonade as much as there was in those days.
Not so much. And your mum, she was an antiques collector?
She was a dealer, yes. She was an antique dealer.
Are you a dealer as well at times?
A wheeler and a dealer. So you have to be, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, do. But there was loads of music. And then the family was uprooted. What age were you when the family left Wicklow?
I was 12 when we went to Manchester.
Wow. That was a big severance in your life, I'd imagine.
It was a big thing, but I really embraced it. I liked the new start and the whole kind of different culture and the shopping in Manchester. There wasn't much to buy in Arklow or try on. When I went to Manchester first, I used to go to Debenhams quite regularly and just spend hours in there trying on dresses and what have you. So, yeah, it was a big change for me, but we had lots of family in Manchester. Mm-hmm. We have a big kind of, there's an annex of the family that are from Manchester. And so, yeah, it's a great town.
Did it feel Irish anyway in Manchester?
It did. I went to a Catholic school and we had lots of family, Irish family that were already ensconced in Manchester.
Because at 12, obviously, you lose your friends in Arklow, but you're saying the family, there were plenty of cousins, people to be friends with over there.
That's right. Yeah. I had been to Manchester a lot on holidays anyway, so I was already familiar with it.
Also, Manchester had, I think what you've described previously, is a community of weirdos.
That's what I found, yes. Yeah. I was about sort of 14, I think, when I started going to see live music with my little group of friends who were, would identify as weirdos, I guess, in those days.
And those weirdos became your home.
Exactly. And they became my education in many ways.
Do you remember the first gig you saw in Manchester, or what kind of really struck you?
Well, I went to see, the main one was the Sonic Youth gig, which changed everything for me. And I was 14, and that was when, after I'd seen Sonic Youth, I really threw myself into the music scene. I really threw myself into buying records and, you know, never thinking that I was going to make music, but just being really obsessed with it. And my little group of friends were all obsessed with it. So it was something to do.
It was your way of life. And meanwhile, around this time, your family moved back to Wicklow.
Yes, bit by bit. Yeah.
But you stay?
I stayed, yes.
You were only about 15, I think. Was that considered very unusual at the time?
It was, but not quite as unusual as it is now.
Yeah.
It's kind of totally unbelievable now, but it was, it was unusual then too, I suppose.
And here you were doing things your way. That was probably the start of you being such an independent artist and having your own self-drive, I'd imagine.
It was a big moment for me to make that decision. I could have gone back to Ireland with my mother, but because I was just so happy with my little gang of mates and because it was possible for me, I mean, I was able to get a little apartment and the government paid for it, and I carried on and I did my A-levels and I stayed in the same area, and I was very close to, you know, just geographically to friends and friends' mums, and you know, I was actually quite taken care of, really.
You must be amazed at yourself, though, looking back at a 15-year-old.
I am. Yeah. I draw on that strength whenever I need it, you know. Whenever I think things might get too much for me, I think, well, geez, you managed when you were 15 in Manchester, so.
You've done worse, says you.
Yeah.
At what stage then did you decide, right, I'm going to do this for a living, this is my life?
Well, I was 19 when I met Mark Bryden, who was my partner in Moloco, but also my partner. He, you know, we fell in love and started making music immediately. But not in a way where I thought I was a serious singer or anything. In the beginning, it was just being very experimental and playing with characters and ideas and stuff, rather than thinking of myself as some sort of serious singer. And I was really surprised that we got a record contract fairly quickly. And I was surprised that Mark Bryden, who was a proper producer and all, and it was a good bit older than me, wanted to do it. I couldn't believe it, to be honest. But and it was like an amazing gift.
And it was kind of an instant formation, wasn't it, Moloco? And your chat
it was.
Up, your chat up line became quite a
it was my
statement.
Chat up line that got me there. Yeah, I sidled up beside him in a party in Sheffield and said, "Do you like my tight sweater? See how it fits my body." I was saying this thing over and over again that night, and he was like, "I want to record you saying that." And that was the beginning of everything.
He did. And that was the title of, it was the title of the album, or was it the title of the single?
Yeah, Do You Like My Tight Sweater became the title of the album.
Yeah.
Yes.
Extraordinary. And then the big hits follow. Does the style come instantly, or when do you become the style icon?
I always loved clothes. Always, even in Arklow. I mean, I used to raid me Auntie Linda's closet for all her like little 60s dresses, and she had been a beauty queen and she'd saved everything, and she had crowns and dresses and everything. So I used to prance around in Arklow in her wedding dress.
Really? Did she
I
know about
loved
it?
Clothes. I didn't have many, and I certainly, you know, wasn't spoiled that way, but I was obsessed with clothes, and I loved movies and things like that. So my mum and me used to watch movies, and we'd draw the dresses afterwards, you know, we'd watch something, you know, some period pieces. And I don't know, I just grew up knowing about clothes as well, because my aunts in Dublin were dressmakers. They were all, my mother's grandfather was a tailor, and everybody knew how to make clothes. And so, yeah, there was a lot of talk about clothes and fabrics and colours and styles, and I was just brought up around it. It was something that was in me.
When you were putting on the clothes, did you see them as a costume for yourself? Were you trying to be somebody else or emulate someone you saw in a film?
I would be a bit fantastical about it, yeah. The fantasies would grow, and, you know, I'd dress up as things, and, yeah, I was never afraid to be that way, you know.
Thank goodness, says you, because it's such an important part of particularly your live performances, the fashion.
It is, yeah, it can be. Fashion, costume, fantasy, I suppose, yeah. And characterization and telling stories. And it's just the sort of handiest thing you can grab, really, isn't it, to start telling stories with.
It must be a nightmare for the roadies.
I have a roadie, yes. I don't have like a fancy wardrobe person, because
really?
it's too hectic. I had tried once or twice, and they kind of end up pulling their hair out. So now for the last several years, I have a guy called Simon Phillips, who's my roadie.
Yeah.
He's my specific roadie, and he's a big, strong chap that carries all these suitcases, and he's learned to steam, he's learned to hem.
Wow.
And people are quite surprised when I turn up with him.
A miser suitcase. I always think trunks for those outfits, because, you know, you can't really sit down in a lot of the costumes for fear of crushing the
shape. Some of the suitcases only have one thing in them, yes.
Okay, that's the way to travel. So there's no Roisin Murphy department working day and night and travelling around with you. It's basically you and a roadie.
It's me and a roadie, but he is my department, yes.
He's my
everything.
You don't have to remember the movies that kind of struck you, because the costuming seems to come from the movies before you're dressing up your aunt's clothes.
I was movie obsessed as a kid, yeah. Oh. And so my mum was too. So that was something we shared very much.
You set a standard with the fashion that plenty of people are following now, Lady Gaga and Sam Smith and so on. The men rarely don elaborate clothing, don't they? Are they lucky, or are they missing out?
I think there's a bit of both there, for sure. I love men's clothes too. And I kind of dress more like that in real life, you know. I wear trousers all the time and shirts, and yeah, I love men's clothes as well as women's. I love all clothes.
You do?
I should say it's love-hate, because you have to take care of them all as well. It's a big job.
You can fall out with clothes as well, that's for sure.
You can.
I presume the drama of the style means that when you're in your whatever counts as civilian clothes for Roisin Murphy, that people don't probably spot you as much on the street.
That's right. I go under the radar, for sure.
So it's a mask on stage in many ways.
No, it's not a mask. It's something I use to tell stories with, or even to tell the truth with, you know. I think you can mask up quite easily by just wearing T-shirts and jeans and being like, I'm very, very authentic. That in itself can be nonsense, you know, as well. So I don't know. I mean, I think in the beginning, I thought I came into the music industry in the 90s, and we had like grunge and stuff like that. And everything was very serious and very underplayed. And I reacted to that, you know, I reacted against it.
You certainly did. You went back recently. Well, you was it a week ago or 2 weeks ago? You said you were back in Arklow. You've been calling for an art centre in Arklow. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I think there's a great opportunity. We have a harbour down there that's kind of the most you know, romantic place in Arklow, and there's nothing going on down there, and there's loads of warehouses and stuff like that. And I just thought it would be a great place to, you know, have a, like a Brooklyn down there, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's just an idea, basically.
And it would be kind of full circle for you, wouldn't it? Because your grandfather was deeply involved in bringing music to the town.
He was, yeah, absolutely. My grandfather, my mother's father, started by having a marquee. So he used to throw dances in the marquee in Arklow, which became very famous and everybody came down to it. And then he built a ballroom. And then he built the cinema. He built the centre, which was another place for music and culture. He built a big restaurant called Bumtaz, which is what was still in the family when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But yeah, he brought a lot of entertainment to Arklow, exactly.
Bill Kavanagh was his name.
That's right.
What's the shopping like in Arklow these days?
Well, we have TK Maxx, which I always have a little stroll through when I'm there, but you never know what you're going to get.
I'm still recovering from the fact that you found your fashion sense in Debenhams. It's not what we
Cocktail dresses in the 80s in Debenhams. It was great.
And now it's TK Maxx. Oh, no. Kabir, when you talk about your granddad there and bringing the marquee and the ballroom to Arklow, Grim Ireland really kind of survived because of dancing, and the dance spaces are closing one after the other in Ireland and indeed across Britain as well. We need to bring this back. I'm sure you would agree with this.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like the young people are as interested in it as we were. That's kind of, you know, I'm starting to sound like an old one. We used to have to make our own. We used to have to make our own entertainment.
Put on your auntie's wedding dress and dance around the room. But I think they want to dance. They just don't have the spaces for it, and they're not as interested in drinking. So, there isn't the pull factor for them if there isn't just a dance space, maybe.
Well, I mean, they used to dance at tea dances, didn't they? Just go and have a few cups of tea and dance all night.
Alcohol free.
Not in my day. I'm not that old.
I wasn't absolutely not suggesting. You're going home this summer. It is true, isn't it? You haven't actually done a full live show in Wicklow ever before.
That's right, yeah.
Wow. Beyond the Pale Festival. So there'll be dancing opportunities for all comers.
All kinds of dancing, all kinds of music. It's a real mix. It looks like it's going to be a great festival.
Yeah, that's in the middle of June. It'll be a family occasion for you as well, I presume.
It will. Hopefully my Auntie Linda will stick by her promise and turn up, because she's become a bit of a fan favourite, because I've had her on my Instagram a few times and they're all looking forward to meeting her.
Do you still have some of her dresses?
No, God. In fact, she, if you get her going on that, she gets a bit upset, because I did raid that bit by bit by bit. I just emptied her wardrobe and her husband's, which was my Uncle Jim, which was the musician.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You emptied all those closets. There's Linda dress ups for the shows now. She presumably still has glamour.
Oh, yeah. She'll put a bit of effort in, of course. Yeah.
For you, of course. We inevitably get these messages when you talk about, but I worked with Roisin's dad when he had the furniture shop in Arklow. A truly wonderful man, full of life and wisdom. That's from Paul.
Ah, lovely. Yeah.
Nice to have those memories.
Yeah, he's very missed me, Dad.
Ah, yeah. Only in recent years as well.
Yeah, he died a few years ago, two or three years ago.
But you'll get those stories when you come back for Beyond the Pale. Another one says, love Roisin, have danced at her gigs, dressed expressively as only a Roisin Murphy gig would allow. That's from Kay.
I love it when people make an effort when they come to the gigs.
They do.
Yeah.
If you're making the effort, I suppose the rest of us have to as well. Listen, an absolute pleasure chatting to you this morning.
Thank you.
We let you go back into the beauty of Ibiza there. And they're all looking forward to welcoming you back to Wicklow. In the middle of June.
Thank you so much.
June 13th to the 15th, you're headlining the Saturday night, Beyond the Pale. It's beyondthepale.ie is a place for tickets. Roisin Murphy, good morning to you.
Good morning, dear.
Slán.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
And you're very welcome back. 51551. Our ageless visiting critic has entered the studio. Welcome, Dana. Visiting critics, of course, they review something for you that they would never normally do of their own free will. We get them out of their comfort zones into their discomfort zone. And for this week's Critic for Day, explore the world of traditional Irish brush dancing. The winner of Eurovision 1970, she ran for president twice, served as an MEP and still sings her heart out. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
You're a hugger, I noticed. You're hugging all of us this morning.
I think it's very important to hug people.
Yeah, it's scientifically proven.
Absolutely. I tell them it's fat-free. One of the few things in the world.
never worried about calories when it came to hugs before. Okay, but now you give me a different perspective. You've done a lot in your life, as we know. Not many zones left unvisited for you. Do you enjoy putting yourself into a bit of a challenge?
No, I don't enjoy it.
You don't?
I find that it wouldn't be something I'd jump at myself.
Okay.
But if it kind of meets you, then I think you should definitely go for it because you learn a lot about yourself.
True.
Now, as I don't know if your wonderful researcher, Adam, told you, but this was not on my list of things that I wanted to do.
That's right.
The only brush I mentioned was a paintbrush.
And you are a painter.
No, I'm not a painter, but I love sketching. And when I did paint, by the time I got the colour I wanted in the palette, I was at the end of the palette and I didn't have enough paint to put, and then I didn't know how I got there. So I did say I'd love to know how to mix the colours. But I ended up with a substantially bigger brush.
One for dancing.
One for dancing.
What kind of hobbies do you do? Sketching, you said.
I like sketching, but we have grandchildren and actually you don't do much sketching. I'm now learning the moves of Ronaldo.
It's really
sad. Yes.
That's for one of the grandkids.
Oh, yes.
Big football
both of
fan.
The grandkids, and they're amazing. So I tell them that I taught Ronaldo everything he knows. And I don't know why the look of doubt comes over their face, Oliver.
Ronaldo's 40, so it's kind of amazing to that.
Oh, when I get to be 40, I might stop.
maybe so. You like sketching. Would you be sketching landscapes when you do get the time and the grandkids aren't taking up all your time?
Well, I do. I do like landscapes. And it's very therapeutic and I enjoy it.
You've always done it?
I did, yeah, from a child. Yeah.
From childhood, singing all along the way. What else? Are there other hobbies we don't know about?
Well, I used to love embroidery.
Used to?
Uh-huh. Again, it takes a lot of time. And I knew nothing about embroidery. And Oliver, I discovered that my grandmother on my father's side, who died before I was born, was a professional embroiderer.
All right.
And I don't know, when I started to do it, I just felt something inside went, oh, I love this.
It's in the blood.
It must be. I'm sure things pass on, you know.
And you don't do it now?
I would do it, but I just don't seem to have time. It's the dribbling that gets me, see, the Ronaldo dribble. I just have to concentrate on that at the moment.
It sounds like the grandchildren take up a lot of your time.
Oh, yes. And I mean, you have to get fit or die. So I was glad I left the choice to Adam and possibly your team or possibly yourself. And I did tell
Adam all the way.
If I survived, I would come in and do the programme.
Oh, God.
But here I am.
You didn't tell the insurers that. But
I might have said you'll hear from my lawyer.
Oh, no. Come here. You live in the west of Ireland these days, in Galway.
We do. We live in Galway.
For a fair while now, over 10 years.
It's the longest we've lived anywhere.
Is it?
We're there. I'm not going to get my maths together, but we're there since 1999.
Oh, right. OK, that's 26 years now. And you were born in London?
Born in London, raised in Derry.
Were you a toddler when you came to Derry?
I was about 5 or 6.
Oh, were you? OK, so you might have memories of... Do you have memories of...
I do have quite clear memories of London. We lived in Frederica Street. Mm-hmm. And I had a little friend lived across the street called Loopy Lou. And we lived in one of those big Georgian houses, you know, where you walked in and down steps to the kitchen and then the different floors above.
Wow.
And, you know, a funny thing, one of my sons was working in London. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be in conversation a couple of years ago with him and I mentioned Frederica Street and he said, I used to jog to work down Frederica Street.
Really?
And yeah, of course.
It's a posh street, is it?
Well, it is now.
It is now.
It is now. Then it was kind of after the war and it was bomb damaged and, you know, but
tumbled down.
Great people. Great people.
And Derry, how long did you actually live in Derry then? Because you moved.
Well, up until Eurovision.
Oh, yeah.
Well, but you were actually, a teenager, weren't for you? A couple of years after that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. All through my teens. And a couple of years after that. And then the travel became impossible because at that time you'd have to get back to Belfast on a flight and drive a couple of hours to Derry.
On merciful roads.
Oh, and often I'd get my suitcase to the bottom of the stairs and I'd never get it up the stairs.
Really?
Yeah, just continually moving.
And where did you move to then?
And then I moved to London. We lived first with my uncle in London, and then I bought a house in the north of London. And we were very, very happy there. Yeah.
And in America, was it Alabama you were in?
We were in Alabama.
Did you spend long there?
We were 8 years there.
Oh, 8 years. Okay, so you've surpassed. 8 years. Yes, yes.
And, you know, I didn't really want to go to Alabama because I had the only... In fact, I wasn't keen to live in America because I only had experience of what I saw, streets of San Francisco and Miami Vice, you know what I'm saying?
Two very different worlds.
Oh, definitely,
there, yeah.
Definitely different. And for Alabama, like dirt tracks and burning crosses on the lawn. And I was
burning
really,
crosses?
Well, that's what you see in
that's
films.
The imagery from film, yes, I guess.
That's what you see. And we went there and the people were just beautiful. And we grew to love it very much and we made lots of friends there. So it's a lesson through life, you know, take people as you find them.
Yeah, you can have a view of a place. No more exactly. than the Americans have a view of Ireland and not understand the country as it is today.
But of course it is true. We do have leprechauns and we do have fir trees.
we do.
Yeah, we do.
We have covered this programme for sure.
Yeah.
I'll come back to brush dancing in a second, but sorry, we've got a different route here. Was it roasting in Alabama all the time?
Oh God, I got there in October. The family got there in August. I just thought I might as well just die because all my clothes were from here, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you're dressed
and
for Ireland.
I the humidity, it was unbelievable. And it really took getting used to. Of course, kids, they are just so quick. They're out running about and you're just like vaping away, dying.
Vaporising.
Yes.
And what was it? Did you live in a city or were you out in the country on a rocking chair in a porch?
Well, I'll tell you, we did have a porch.
Did you?
And we did have a rocking chair.
Oh, I love those. I love that. Kind of
yeah, thing. It was, Damien was the first of his family to leave Ireland.
Yeah.
And he's the youngest of 15. And his eldest sister, the matriarch, was frantic with worry that her baby was going to America. And she had a call from a woman who lived there. And she said, don't worry at all. She says, it's just like Wicklow. And the minute she said that, Josie was perfectly at peace.
That was all it took.
And where we lived was just like Wicklow.
Really?
It was in the foothills of the Appalachians, just outside Birmingham itself.
Yeah.
And little windy roads and hills up and down. And it was absolutely beautiful.
That sounds stunning.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Do they have Spanish moss in the trees there? Is that a more Louisiana thing?
I don't think I know what Spanish moss is.
The nice thing that hangs off the trees.
Well, I'll say yes because you won't know if I'm lying or not.
Oh, you would have heard about it, sure.
We were surrounded by Spanish moss.
Now I have the image.
I don't want to burst your bubble.
Oh, there's mischief in there for sure. That's hence the name, isn't it? Isn't Donna that became Dana? Is that true?
Well, yeah, I didn't know that. It was actually the True Hood the Dana was the one I would have preferred.
Oh, really? The True Hood the Dana, yeah.
I definitely preferred that.
The other people.
But too late, I admitted it was because it was mischievouser that I got the name.
You
nice
reputation.
Of you to bring it up.
Reputation as a child for being a little bit Donna. But that's not
yes.
That's absolutely fine. So come here, brush dancing. Tell us why. We would have thought dancing, surely someone who's been in music all her life, dancing would be a very comfortable place to dwell.
Well, I never studied Irish dance and it's a particular discipline.
Yeah.
I did ballet and I loved it.
Right.
And I wanted to do both, but at that time you weren't allowed. Because the arms were different, the feet were different,
mm-hmm.
and so I did ballet.
Were you good at it?
A ballet?
Yeah.
Well, I did it from I was 6 till I was 17.
Really?
And I I at one time wanted to teach it, but then Eurovision got in the way.
It did change your life.
Yeah.
And you're sitting down, aren't you, in that Eurovision? You don't...
I sat down.
There's no dancing.
No.
They missed a trick there.
A lot of countries thought I couldn't stand. Yeah, they'd always have a stool ready.
You're sitting in a stool.
Yes.
Everywhere you went to do the interviews.
Would you like a stool? Yes. And so when I walked in, Adam said, would you like to sit there? It just goes on. No, but...
You're sitting down now?
Yes, I'm sitting now. But yeah, I forgot what you asked me.
It was about dancing, and I thought that would be a comfortable place. So you were good at ballet, but Irish dancing, it's a bit like speaking Osqueilig, isn't it? If we're nervous about it, we won't go near
it. It's very different.
Irish dancing can be similar.
Yeah. I did have an experience in Donegal during my political days when I went there, and I was invited to an afternoon ceilidh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it's the rite of passage for politicians, isn't
Lord.
It?
Oh, Lord. And this very elegant, very distinguished 80-year-old gentleman asked me to be his partner in one of the dances. Yeah. I had to ask him, could I sit down? Because I couldn't breathe.
Oh, really? You flung you around?
I couldn't breathe, and he was still going strong. So that kind of put me off. And then before that, a dear friend of mine, Bill Hughes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Bill Hughes?
Could do, of course.
He's
yeah.
a great producer. Mm-hmm. He asked me, would I do jigs and reels?
Oh, that's right.
And I wasn't going to do it, but he's very persuasive.
Yeah, right, okay.
So I did it. I thought, 2 weeks, I'll be home. 1 week to learn the first dance, and you don't get knocked out. Nobody gets knocked out. The next week, I'll be home. Well, I got through to the finals. But my partner was Ronan McCormick, and I was convinced he was trying to kill me on the first rehearsal. And then he said, let's take it up to speed.
And you did.
Oh, I nearly died.
It was kind of Irish dancing to modern music.
To modern music. Okay. So you didn't really
This was
get
much more pure, what you experienced.
Yes, okay. You didn't get into the basics.
I see, yes. It wasn't time on the telly programme.
Well, no, but Ronan was such a fabulous dancer.
And this time you met Siobhan Manson from the Irish Dance Experience. This was in Clada Hall in Galway, I
yes,
believe.
Yes.
And she was going to bring you through a class on brush dancing.
Yes. So I asked her what did she normally do? So she normally begins with the basic step, the 1, 2, 3.
Very good. Indo 3.
I'd never started from the 1, 2, 3.
Aha, you were always flung into jigs and reels and ceilidhs.
Flung into everything. So she taught me that. And the, you know, where you bring your leg up, hop, and you go to the side.
Yeah, yeah.
I never could get that right in my life. And she fixed that. And we did a little ceilidh dance first.
Very good.
Then we did the brush dance. And then we did river dance.
Oh, right.
Well, of course, she did river dance and I did the 1, 2, 3 beside her. But as I said to her, Shireen, I'll be able to say I did river dance now. And it was thrilling. I was nervous. I thought I might be going into a room full of people and memories of Donegal ceilidh came back. But and I was afraid she might be Ronan on speed, you know, Ronan McCormick. But she was absolutely lovely. She
was a one-on-one.
She was elegant. She looked just like the lead dancer should look in Riverdance. Mm-hmm. As my mother would say, there was more fat on a chip. So I knew this was the way to get fit. She said it was a cardio workout. It was. But it was, I don't know, I just really enjoyed it.
Did you?
I really enjoyed it.
Did all of your nervousness of, I can't do this dancing, even the basics, melt away?
Well, eventually.
Eventually, yeah.
And
came, 90 minutes, I think.
Came back abruptly when we were doing the brush dance.
It's hard, isn't it? That's legitimately hard.
The 1, 2, 3s around the brush are okay. Then you have to go over the brush back and forth.
Yeah.
That gets the heart going. And then you have to lift the end of the brush and you have to kind of swing it, your leg over it. And at that point, I said, you do that and I'll watch. You do it and I'll watch.
Is it a normal sweeping brush?
No, it's a broom.
Oh, it's a broom?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a broom. It wouldn't be the same with a brush.
Not great at sweeping, is it, the broom?
No, it doesn't look very elegant.
No, but the witches seem to like it anyway.
Yeah, I didn't get on it, but I just watched it. And she was so good. So she does this with groups of, you know, tourists or students.
You got very special treatment because you're Dame Dana.
Oh, thank you.
So you got one of them. Well, usually it's a group. Obviously, people prefer the group because it can melt into the background a little bit. And
I think so. But she was so lovely and very patient. And I am very unfit at the minute. And
I know you were telling our man, Adam, that you've been fit all your life. You've kept fit.
I've always been very fit. And now I'm not. And I'm also, it's not to do with weight. It's to do with fitness. Mm-hmm. But I'm overweight. So
You're hard on yourself.
No, I'm I'm very honest, unfortunately, about myself.
Are you always worried about weight?
Well, I did a television programme with Daniel recently, and you never really see yourself until you watch yourself on television. True. Then you're 10 pounds heavier anyway.
That's what they say.
Oh, but my goodness, I look like a red blob.
You look nothing of the sort, by the way, but it is.
You didn't see the programme, did you?
I'm looking at you now. You look amazing, by the way.
I've lost a pound.
Just from the dancing.
I had to do something coming in to meet you.
Oh, for God's sake. Someone's saying, I've never met this delightfully witty side of Dan before. Loving this chat. We're all find out new things.
This is just me.
Yeah, it is. It's just you. Unadulterated. I have to read out this other
man. How dare you?
My uncle, well, in showbiz, people put on a different front, but you're just yourself today. My uncle Anthony was Dana's singing teacher. This is from Brian and Derry.
Oh, thank you. Do you remember Anthony?
Do you remember an Anthony who was a singing teacher?
I do.
You had loads of them, I presume. But now you've got a dancing teacher.
Yes.
The irishdanceexperience.com is where you can book dancing lessons with Siobhan Manson. Mm-hmm. But you highly recommend it, despite being...
I do. And I would go back, you know, because I think it's a fun way to get the heart going. And especially if you're doing it in a group. I really think it's a healthy way, because you're not... It's not you and a machine.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's great endorphins out of it.
Yeah, really, truly.
It's music.
It's really good.
Will you be now dancing across the sweeping brush at home, or will you stick to the Ronaldo dribbling in the lawn?
I have to work on the dribbling first, and then I'll try dribbling with a brush.
How many grandchildren do you have, by the way?
Well, we have three in Ireland.
Yeah.
Sydney and Timmy and Ralph.
Lovely.
And we have two in Australia, and we have three in Africa.
Oh, wow. In Africa.
Your typical Irish family.
Scattered around the world. Do you get to see the ones in Africa and Australia?
They all came. At Christmas, we all went there. We always try to do a family holiday.
Yeah.
So we all went. COVID, of course, ruined it for every family.
Sure, especially Australia.
So we went there for Christmas to Africa. And then everyone came for the summer, last summer, to Ireland. For my husband had a big birthday. That was lovely. We went down to Dingle and the kids, they all kind of slotted age-wise. No fighting. There was no fighting.
Very rare.
Except among the adults. But there was no fighting among the children. It was really lovely.
And where in Africa are they based?
They're in Kenya, in Nairobi.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, so we went on safari and...
Yeah.
It was... Something I would never have chosen to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you get those videos where they're going through the safari park.
I know, yeah.
And like a lion jumps up.
That's right. They're the only videos you see.
So that was my fear.
It's your fear, yeah.
Yeah.
So you get out of your comfort zone quite a lot. Very busy.
Yeah.
It is Eurovision time of the year. Do you get nostalgic when you hear it being mentioned in the news here and there and go, that was me back in 1970?
Yeah, you know, I've always watched Eurovision when I can. Didn't in America. When I came back, it had suddenly evolved to a different level because they were in stadiums, not theatres.
Yeah.
That's very hard for an artist because you have to play to the stadium, but you have to have the intimacy of in somebody's living room.
For the TV.
Yeah, it's very hard. Yeah.
It was very intimate in your day, wasn't
yes.
it? It was a TV show really only.
In the theatre.
Yeah,
so that was an adjustment. And I'd always get nervous when the Irish entrant was going on.
Is that because you put yourself into
this? Yeah, I could just feel what they were feeling.
Which is?
Heart pounding. You know, you really get nervous till they get through it. So I'd always feel that.
Wow. Do you kind of like, does your breath catch and go, is it fear or is it excitement?
Well, no, it's fear. It's anxiety.
I gather your main memory of winning in 1970 was the homecoming, coming home.
Oh, it was wonderful. was really wonderful.
An Aer Lingus plane with your name on the side of it.
Like, who'd have thought? A wee girl from the flats in the Bogside. And when we left, there was two cleaners and a porter waved us goodbye.
Is that right, on the way out?
Yeah, no, that's the truth.
Okay.
I went in to use the loo and the two cleaners were in there and said, going to Eurovision. And then she called the porter and they waved us goodbye. And we came back and they were, oh my, there's thousands hanging off the building. Anytime I come into Dublin or out of Dublin and by the old building, I just visualise it.
What is the name of the street in Derry in your honour?
Oh, and it's not in Derry, it's in County Down.
Oh, is it?
Dana Place.
Dana Place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Johnny Logan must be furious.
Oh, Johnny. Do you know, I've known Johnny since he was a little boy. Do you know his father was a very, very famous Irish tenor?
Oh, no, I don't know.
Now, am I educating you now?
You are.
And his daddy is from Derry.
Right.
Yeah. His
so
singing name
well.
Was Patrick O'Hagan. And he was his own name was Sherrod. And Johnny, I met him, I was about 15 and I don't know what age. Johnny was a few years younger. I'm so proud of Johnny Logan.
You were all friends with the former Eurovisions winners.
Yes.
Linda Martin, is she a pal?
Linda, I've known since the 70s. We've been friends since then. And she's a formidable woman.
She told us in this programme she's considering a run of the Auras.
And she has every right to be. As soon as she gets to be 35, she can do it.
Has she been in touch with you about since you have experience of doing it twice?
No, she hasn't been in touch yet. But, you know, we'll see how she gets on if she decides to go that route. But she's a bit young at this time.
Now, I think you might have gone over to 35 because you've run twice before.
Yes.
You snuck in, obviously, the first time in 97.
I suppose I can't say I lied about my age.
Your experience was absolutely grueling and just about survived it, I would say. What would your advice be to people considering running for this unmerciful election?
Well, I tell you, I was the first independent that was ever nominated.
That's right, through the county council.
And one of the reasons I ran was because the presidency belongs to the people. And yet it was only the political parties who had the keys to the park.
Yes.
And it was so undemocratic. And I think maybe because in the North, we'd seen the result of a lack of democracy.
I don't get to vote in the North either.
No, I have to speak up if I think somebody is not being treated right, you know. And often you don't want to speak up, but you do. And you do that too. And you have every right to speak your mind. You don't have to agree with you or agree with you, but I really admire that in you. You speak your mind. And we're in a country where you should be able to do it. But I always have a graph for independence because it's a harder road. And you have to really believe and want to do it as an independent. But, you know, I would love to, you know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see a young family in the park. Because young families are being battered today. It's so hard for them. Financial pressures and trying to keep up jobs and mortgages. I'd love a young family in the park that would relate with what is really our present and our future.
You like the symbolism of that?
Oh, yeah, not just the symbolism, but this connecting and knowing what they need and just supporting them.
Did you do you regret running for the president twice?
No, I don't regret anything I've done because I did it the second time, especially because of the constitutional protection that we needed and to highlight that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a truly terrible time.
True. That's what I wonder that you must think, I wish I didn't do that. Have you properly recovered from it? No appears to be the answer. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you, but I can see that you're upset. And this obviously people will know there were false accusations against your family and so on. A very thoroughly unpleasant time. And you've cheered us up this morning, I can tell you.
Do you know, it's like a well of grief.
Wow. This would be the kind of thing you would have to advise contenders for the Auras.
Yes, you have to absolutely believe that it's what you have to do, and not just for yourself, for a reason, you know, for the good of other people, that you hope it will be. And then you take whatever comes.
I'm sorry if I've upset you.
I am sorry. Oh, Lord, it's well seen that men don't wear mascara. No, I...
Are you all right?
I'm okay as long as I don't think about it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary thing to have gone through. You have great faith. That must help you.
It does. And the love from the people of this country.
I'll give you some messages here from people. People are sending in lovely things.
Only the good ones.
They're only good ones. Lovely to hear Dana on the radio. It was a huge moment for Ireland when the Eurovision was such a big part of her lives. She always seemed so calm and serene. That's true. Dana's such a breath of fresh air, so funny. I met her for the first time last year. I heard her sing in my local chapel. She sings with such feeling. I've also managed to receive one of her hugs. God bless her, says Porrick.
<That's>
You give out your hugs, that's for sure. I was 13 when Dana won the Eurovision and was obsessed with her. I had a scrapbook full of newspaper pictures of her. I actually sketched Dana and sent the image to her. She sent me a lovely autographed photo of herself in return, which made my day. Please say hello to me, to her from me. That's from Dimpna.
Oh, that's lovely.
I'd say she voted for you. 2 weeks ago, I asked Dana, would she visit my auntie, sister Katie in Taylor's Hill in Galway? Both she and her husband visited. Dana spent an hour there and sang all kinds of everything. My aunt, who has dementia, sang the song with her.
She knew all the words. All the words. It was so beautiful. And this is my 55th anniversary. And actually, on the 21st of March, I was invited to come to the National School in Rush. Mm. Great headmaster there. And the first class sang for me.
Yeah, this was on the way out to Eurovision in 1970.
No, this was this year.
This year.
And the first class sang it for me with all the actions and another little class with them, and was so beautiful, Oliver.
That's lovely. We'll enjoy that anniversary. And thanks so much for coming in and trying the brush dancing and being such a great sport.
And I do apologise.
Don't at all. I'll give you another hug on the way out. That's
Will you?
Dana, Dame Dana, I should say. Back shortly after these. We'll take a break.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
And you're welcome back. The WhatsApp 087 032 32 32. Now, it is set in Mayo during the county championships. And in this new novel, Fun and Games, we find out the full lynx-scented cruelty of 17-year-old lads waiting for their Leaving Cert results, slagging each other over their mothers, the girlfriends, the progress of their sex lives, the whole lot. There's a family wedding thrown in and reminders that the CAO college ambitions are utterly loaded with social class snobbery in Ireland, and the jokes land like jets at Heathrow. We'll come to that in a moment. John Patrick McHugh, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Oliver. It's lovely to be here.
And congratulations. This is a big moment, isn't it, in a young writer's life?
It's amazing, yeah. My debut novel, it feels really special. My collection of stories came out during COVID, so it's very nice to be actually able to go to things and celebrate it properly. So yeah, it feels very special.
That was pure gold.
A lot of excitement
going for it. Are you from Galway?
I was born in Galway. Moved around Cork as a child, and I moved back to Galway when I was 12. But my mother is from Achill Island. So all throughout my childhood, teenagehood, that's where we went back to, Achill Island. Her family are all from there. So I kind of feel like that was the kind of stable home as I moved around. But I am probably a Galway boy, true and true.
You identify a Galway, and you followed Galway in the championship last year, religiously.
Yeah, maybe body of a Galway person, heart of a Mayo person. But yeah, I went to. It was a beautiful summer following Galway along. And yeah, it was so special.
If you were living in Cork as a child, once it had to be some force to pull that identity. It's Mayo.
The earliest memories of watching football are my mother screaming at the TV as Mayo miss points or stuff like that. So yeah, it's been a constant in my life.
Constant heartache.
Yeah,
says you.
Yeah.
And come here, did you go to college in Dublin for a time?
I went to college in Galway. I went to, University of Galway, as it's called now. So I did my BA there, and then I went over to Norwich and I did a master's in creative writing there.
Ah, yeah. Because you've been all around the place.
I know. Globe setter.
But Galway's home now.
Galway Galway is home now. We moved back in January of this year, so very lovely to be back in the
Did you move back from England?
Moved back from Dublin.
Oh, so you were in Dublin?
I was in Dublin for about 8 years. Oh, yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
You'd have to read a novel to find out where you've been. This book is set in 2009. Why did you choose that year?
2009? Yeah, I picked it because, well, one, I didn't want any kind of international soccer tournaments to distract my boys. I wanted to be very kind of intense and isolated. But also, like, 2009 was such a great year, and just in terms of phones were kind of there, but they weren't all consuming. As you touched on earlier, the music was amazing. And I just
didn't know until this morning, to be honest.
But yeah,
are you a Leaving Cert in 2009?
That is probably also the reason why it's 2009. I did do my Leaving Cert that year. So I can confirm that we went in and I got our paper results off.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for the kids who don't get that ritual.
Yeah, the scariness of being handed the brown envelope and then peeling it back. And yeah, my mother trying not to look at me as I read the results.
That's where that whole scene comes from. That is a real dramatic
moment. Yeah, yeah.
You better tell us about Fun and Games then, because John is the lead character in this. Tell us about John Masterson.
John Masterson, who is not me. He's not related to me. So John Masterson is a 17-year-old boy, and he's beginning that kind of last summer before he leaves for college after the Leaving Cert. He's not really a boy. He's not really a man. And him and his friends are kind of dealing with the future and what it means to be a future. He's also dealing with a lot of family drama. His mom and dad are kind of slowly slitting apart. A private message from his mother has been leaked across the island, so that's causing him a lot of trouble. Yeah. And he works in a hotel and he's trying to get on the senior football team. And most importantly, he meets a young woman called Amber Gould, and he begins this kind of romantic relationship or situationship throughout that summer. Yeah.
It is that complicated.
It is that complicated. Yeah, yeah.
And we're with John the whole way through. So
we're in his head, and that was kind of really important for me. I really wanted to kind of get at his kind of syntax, his language, and to kind of see from his point of view, which, as you said, can be fun, but it can also be quite painful and quite raw. But I think that's important. I think that's what fiction can do. It can get at the truth in a way that maybe nonfiction sometimes can't.
I read it in the Mayo accent, actually. Do people do that when they're reading? I think they do, don't they?
Yeah. Well, it has the Mayo flair, a bit of Galway slang. It's all kind of mixed in there, yeah.
The dialogue is just brilliant because it's really believable. We do feel like we're in the gang of kids. And it's quite po-faced to say it's about masculinity and class. It is like an adventure yarn as well through a summer.
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's obviously serious stuff I want to tackle in there, but I also want to entertain people. That's what books are for.
Yeah.
And I love the dialogue. I love the boys. I still laugh at my jokes. Even if no one will, I laugh at those jokes. But yeah, it was important to get the dialogue right. A lot of reading it aloud, a lot of editing and stuff like that. But yeah, it was important to maybe tackle tough issues, but also have a story where people care. I want people to care for John Masterson. I want them to care for these boys, even if they might offend now and again.
Yeah, and a little mild warning that, you know, there's adult content in the novel, and we want to talk about that because it's about the casual cruelty, isn't it? It's slagging. It's a bit of fun when you're reading it and you go, oh, it goes to dark places as well. Brenda Courtney was talking about nicknames in his show yesterday, filling in for Ray. And nicknames are important, and John is hurt early on, isn't he? Because
Yeah. So nicknames were a thing I've always kind of been fascinated by, because they can be so cruel, and yet, particularly for boys, they can be so cruel at the beginning, and yet by the end, they're almost lovable. You know, they almost come this like endearment, you know, that you're looking for the guy who maybe pooed his pants in first class and he's still called Poo Pants, you know, and you're like, it's this like lovable term. So John has a nickname.
It's fine. Yeah,
he's a nickname.
I've given the warning.
Yeah, so yeah, his
because
nickname,
of the mother,
his mother's
in the sexting.
Private message was leaked, so he's been called Tits throughout that summer by his friends. And it comes to a point where you almost forget the cruelty of it. You start laughing.
I was literally about to say that by the time you're halfway through, you're going, oh, well, that's his name is Tits, and it loses that kind of meaning.
Yeah,
and the savagery or something.
And it only Amber is the one who actually kind of reckons with it, asks him, does that not hurt your feelings? I think that maybe that's the weirdness of being a boy. Sometimes you can just accept that cruelty and then make it a joke, and then it becomes you. You don't really deal with it. You just kind of accept it. You put it on your back. So again, it was just, I wanted to kind of tackle that and get at that while entertaining, while being funny. And it is a funny nickname, you know, but the boys are also, they're not really helping John deal with this moment.
No.
They're laughing with him, not at him, but they're with him, but they're not really dealing with the emotional kind of problem. And I think maybe that's a general issue with a lot of young boys.
He's carrying it around, but his mum is a very strong character, and she's kind of moved on with her life, obviously unaware of that.
Yeah, well, I've been raised by very strong Mayo women, my mother, my aunt, and my grandmother, Annie Catherine. So, yeah, I was just fascinated. Could I show a character who Well, two characters. I didn't want either parent to be the bad guys. I'm not interested in that. I wanted a bit of grey. But Yvonne, the mother character, is a strong woman. She's probably someone who put her life on hold for her kids. And now as they're kind of leaving the nest, she's reckoning with, what am I doing with my life? What do I want to do? And they're very complicated questions. And because we see it from John's point of view, I think a lot of the book is John coming of age is the whole tag. But it's also coming to realise that your parents are adults, which is a very strange thing. I think it does happen around 17, 18. You realise they're getting older, a bit frailer, that they have flaws as well.
And they're starting to make plans for their own lives.
Yes.
As she is in this, because the parents are separated, at very early stage of separation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the dad is a kind of a lonely character.
Yeah, Peter is the father. And I love Peter, but Peter is probably, he's a good natured guy. He's someone who, he means well. He loves a lame joke, but he's a decent guy. He's a decent man. And again, that's what I'm interested in, is exploring these decent characters, maybe in unfortunate circumstances, trying circumstances, but showing a bit of humanity despite maybe his flaws, despite maybe his mistakes. He's still a nice guy. And their relationship is kind of, by the end of the novel, it almost like controls the whole narrative, which again, I was interested in to almost see if I can get into GA, get in the situationship and also have the family in the background.
The father-son relationship is quite loving, actually, isn't it? That's kind of surprised me, I have to say.
And I didn't want to do the classic trope of the silent father, the father who is abusive to the son. This is a guy who loves the son, and by the, you know, he cares for the son, goes to all the matches, cheers him on. And yet, you know, he has his flaws. There's still friction there. Maybe John Maston doesn't appreciate this as much, but this is, that's growing up. You never appreciate kindness, do you, when you're growing up, especially from authority figures?
Take it for granted.
Yeah, completely.
Amber is the girl at the centre of the situationship. She's a little bit older than John, so she's considered ancient, obviously, straight away. But she's at the core of his attitudes towards women that were obviously inside his head. And that's kind of, that might frighten some people if they don't understand the heads of teenagers.
Yeah, you know, it was important that Amber was a couple of years older. She's 19, so John's 17, she's 19. It's only 2 years, but she's outside his social sphere. She's almost past the hierarchy of secondary school. And it's important for John to have someone with that perspective that he could kind of almost see himself from afar through her. And I love Amber. Amber is, she's a tough life. And John is definitely not a fun partner. And there is cruelty in how he thinks of women. There is cruelty in how he deals with Amber. But I also thought that was important to be honest about that.
Yeah.
Because cruelty is often how men treat women. It's often how young boys treat young girls.
It's a reality, isn't it?
It's a reality. And if we don't actually try to engage with it, then what's the point, you know? Obviously, it's a lot in the news these days about adolescence and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And John isn't a psychopath, but
there's no murder or social
media. No murder, no. And he is.
But it does show that kind of that dark side, that dark
completely,
edge.
Completely. The ingrained misogyny, the ingrained sexism. And again, I thought it was important to get at that, and that kind of, I suppose, locker room talk that would have gone on at that age and probably still goes on today.
And it's totally acceptable in that sphere, isn't it? In that group. Now, Kira King, our colleague, we're chatting about your book this morning. She was going by and she was telling us that she wished she read this. She's read it too. She wished she read something like this as a girl when she was a teenager, because she would have understood the stupid teenage head of a boy.
Yeah. And again, it's not just me reporting this stuff for laughs or banter or to get, you know, to shock. I never wanted to shock my readers. It may be shocking, but I feel like it comes from an honest place, a place where I have thought about it and considered it. And I do think that relationship of boys and how they view women is one of fear, a lot of it. You know, John really fears what the boys think about what he thinks.
Yes.
Yeah. So if they don't rate Amber as a beautiful young woman, then John will not rate her as a beautiful young woman. I think that fragile nature of power and social pressure was really, really important for me to kind of explore.
One thing that's really done well is that we get the sensitivity of the teenagers as individuals, which is completely at odds with the collective mob, isn't it? That's has a swagger and a confidence and a belief that everything they believe is true and right.
Yeah, and I've definitely, you know, I've seen it with my own friends, myself. You know, in a group mob, you can be so abusive and loud and boisterous. And then one-on-one, you can be so sensitive and looking for a little hug. I do find boys' friendship endlessly fascinating, because you can have the biggest blowouts. I'm never going to talk to him again. You know, 2 weeks later, you're like hugging and you're best friends. You know, everything's over the top. But there is like a kind of a tenderness to it. And I feel like that tenderness is there between those boys and their friendship. And their friendship is so interesting to me, because they are kind of on that cusp of leaving, And what does it mean for friendship once you leave a secondary school where you're contained within those walls?
The lads are kind of shocked when the John character says, am I a bit fat?
Yeah, like yeah.
The body shaming image.
Body, yeah.
It's all part of it as well.
It is all part. And maybe it's something that I definitely suffered as a teenage boy, my own self-conscious nature when it comes to my body and my weight. And I remember having a similar conversation with a friend when I was putting on a t-shirt, and he was shocked, and he was so tender and kind. I think boys have that kindness in them and yeah. that generosity, and they will support you. But yeah, it was something that I'm always interested in picking, because maybe it's not as reported as other body issues, but male body issues can be a real big issue and a big problem for kids. It can really drag them down. And John is, despite training twice a week throughout this novel, he's still worried about his weight.
Yeah, he still thinks he thinks he's lumpy and he hates his body.
Yeah, there's a real self-loathing in John, despite being a popular boy, despite having friends, despite being loved, and despite also kind of, he does like himself, and yet he also doubts himself throughout. And again, I think that's the contradiction of teenagehood and young manhood that is so kind of fascinating and sad, I think.
Do you sense the same thing happening? Do you know the teenagers now? Is it harder than it was when you were a teenager of the late noughties?
I can only imagine it is. I couldn't imagine living now with phones and the pressure of that. I thought adolescence was very good on just phones, how where they are, they're everywhere, you know? I think it's way harder now. We have a lot of fake idols. You go on Instagram and it's not real, you know, what people are seeing, what they're projecting. So I think it's obviously way tougher for all young people now. I think there's a greater acceptance about being gay, about any queerness and stuff like that, and that's all fantastic. But I do think maybe the standards of beauty, the standards of body image is a lot harder now. I feel for kids these days with the phones. Jesus.
They're very young in gyms as well, aren't they? It's younger and younger.
Yeah, and again, I feel like that kind of feeds into it. Yeah. There's boys, I go to the gym now and I see lads 15, 16 doing weights. And it's like, you don't need to do that, you know.
Bodies aren't developed.
Yeah, you're still kids and you're running around playing GA. That's all you need to
They're
do.
They're on
don't
nutritional
need to.
Programs and like sapping the joy.
It should be fun.
They're having fun in this novel. Hasn't quite exploded yet, has it, in this one. The other thing is that it's a great GAA novel. And are there other great GAA novels? It's kind of, certainly not for this era anyway.
Yeah, there's great non-fiction books on GAA. In recent years, we had Emma Ryan's The Grass Ceiling, which is fantastic, about women's sports. And Kieran Murphy's This is the Life is a brilliant book about it. But yeah, I couldn't think of too many fiction books. And it kind of came very natural to me, the structure, because I remember playing GAA as a teenager, and it was my week. You know, Tuesday was training, Thursday was training. That was kind of the week. And I thought that'd be a great way to structure a novel while still having the family, while still having all the relationships.
An amount of training that's going on. That's where all the tension is relieved.
Grueling.
And also it heightens up quite a lot as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I wanted to challenge myself, could I give readers a sense of what it's like to be on a team, to be training, to kick a football. That was a big thing. I remember my first reader doesn't play football at all, and she read it, and I remember she loving the fact that you could feel like you're kicking a GAA ball. And that was a challenge I wanted to see if I could see that, which is kind of giving a sense to a reader what it's like to be on a GAA team.
To get fouled as well.
To get fouled. Or to foul someone.
Yeah. We're getting clotheslined over the sideline. Yeah. It seems to be a recurring theme. Yeah. But again, it's men getting things out of their system.
It's men. And again, we're very lucky in Ireland for Irish writers, because we have a word like leaving, which is leaving cert. So that's a great word to have in a novel.
That's true, yeah.
And also you have seniors. And I always love this idea of a 17-year-old suddenly on the senior football team.
Yeah.
And the idea of, I remember going into a dressing room as a 17-year-old boy with lads in their 30s, and I had no connection. But then the amazing thing about sport and team sport is suddenly you're on a pitch with them and they're your equals. You know, the camaraderie, the celebration if you get a victory. And yeah, I found the kind of dressing room space kind of really fascinating. And again, I suppose the GAA all ties into John's concern, because every training session is a judgment. Every training session, there's someone who's the best or the worst. And it all kind of ties into John's idea of like society's gaze on him at all times.
Studsy is an important character, and this particularly around that whole social class, where we like to think in Ireland, no, we've no class system here at all. That's only for the Brits. But it's very evident, isn't it?
I think, yeah, I think it's there. I think it's maybe the hidden secret, and maybe it's come more obvious in places like Dublin, but I think around the country, I think it's there. So Studsy would be from maybe a lower economic bracket than John. Has hardship when it comes to paying for college, the idea of getting accommodation, books even. These are concerns John Maston doesn't have. And he's not even aware of it. And I think that maybe that's kind of the problem, I think, that we don't even acknowledge this, how tough it is for someone like Studsy, who likes art, who is a nice lad, kind of, who wants to think of the future, and yet this is kind of taken out of his hands, whereas John doesn't even have to think that it might go. He's just going to go to college. That's what's going to happen to me.
And he's got low self-esteem in this regard, doesn't he? This
Enda
character.
Enda,
I love
yeah.
when you learn his real name every now and again. I go, oh, his name is Enda. Obviously, that's why he's gone to Studsy.
I know. I thought, well, like, you know, there's people I know only by their surname. You know, their nickname. And then when you finally get their first name, you're like, what? No, that's not their name. I remember, yeah, because I'm called John Patrick when I write books. And my uncle went to an event and he was there for 20 minutes. And then afterwards, he was like, talk to me. He's like, oh, no, you're brilliant. I didn't have a clue who this JP fellow was, though, for ages. So nicknames are always a bit of a funny one, yeah.
I heard of a fella in a team once who bought four pairs of jeans in the one day and they called him Spider forever. That's a good one. So they're the serious themes. Going to college, even though they're going from Mayo to Galway, and it's written as though Galway is this metropolis where all the desires and everything would finally be opened up. That is kind of a rite of passage you got to go through as well.
Yeah. So I suppose I was living in Galway, so I never got that maybe transfer to like a college life. But yeah, that kind of change over from secondary school to college life, being freedom and being able to go out and be kind of an adult was amazing. Yeah, and I love the idea of Galway being like this monstrous city, you know, this big city of crack and kiol and all this. So yeah, it was important to have that kind of on the horizon for them to almost eye up and be kind of fascinated by.
What's also great about it is the fact that it's a GA novel, coming of age, and the Brits are loving it.
Yeah, I know.
The Telegraph. You must read this novel about the messiness of young men. The Guardian. It captures the tenderness and menace of young men. That must be a nice...
It's lovely. No, it's been really kind. The reviews have been so lovely. I probably do have to thank Paul Mescal and his lovely little gas shorts for getting that popularity up. But yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I had no worries about it having GA in it, because I think GA is a wonderful sport. It's our national sport. Why shouldn't we write about it? I think it's integral to our culture. We've read enough books about baseball and cricket and stuff like that. So right. Why not GA?
They don't explain it to us.
They don't.
They can look it up on their own time. John Patrick McHugh, thanks so much for coming into us. Fun and Games is the name of the novel. You're launching it tonight in Hodges Figgis in Dublin, the big shop. That's the kind of the moment you've been waiting for, I'm sure, for many times. Is there any other place you want to very, very quickly mention?
I'm doing a festival, the International Literature Festival of Dublin, in the middle of May, which would be great. And then I'm doing an event in Books Upstairs on the 8th of May as well.
Enjoy every minute of it.
Thank you so much, Oliver.
And we'll see you for the next one, I'm sure. I hope it's underway. Fun and Games, John Patrick McHugh. Good luck.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
And there you go, some great interviews from the past week. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you've interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Have a great weekend. Agus slán.